This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Well, as the dot-com bubble was growing ever larger in the late 1990s, the prognosticators, particularly those in the tech industry, thought that their revolution would change everything, including how we shopped. And at first, that seemed kind of ridiculous, especially when the excesses of the bubble exploded on companies like Pets.com. But what if the prognosticators just got a little bit ahead of themselves? After all, Amazon, the king of online retailers, is now worth $110 billion. How much is Macy's worth? $16 billion. JCPenney, $4 billion. Sears, $5 billion. So basically, Amazon could swallow them all whole and have plenty of room to spare. So are we truly now changing our habits as consumers and forever altering the way that malls are built and that towns are laid out? Joining me first is Gina Keating, the author of Netflixed, The Epic Battle for America's Eyeballs. Gina Keating, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you write in Netflixed about the emblematic example of sort of online eating, the brick and mortar stores, Netflix killing Blockbuster. And I wonder, was there a moment, do you think, at which Blockbuster shifted from being totally unaware of what was going to happen to it to understanding that death might be on the way?
Yeah, actually, I think that kind of came in stages to different people in the organization. I think there were some young men inside Blockbuster who realized when they saw the penetration that Netflix was getting in San Francisco in the Bay Area and realized that they were starting to lose store traffic in those same markets, that there was a frisson of dread there. But it took some of the retail types a little bit longer, and I would say that probably in about 2004, when they decided to launch Blockbuster Online, they realized that that market of people who would go online and actually rent movies was much, much larger than they or Wall Street or any of the marketing people who had studied it had realized.
So, I mean, if you have Blockbuster by, like you said, 2004, saying, you know, we've really got to start our own DVD by mail service. This has gotten so big, we need to be a part of it. And Walmart's, you know, trying to get in on it too. Why weren't they able to sort of finish off Netflix at that point?
It was a combination of things. Blockbuster actually in 2007 came very close to killing Netflix, and it was really not because they were great technologically speaking or had any kind of insight into what online consumers wanted. It was simply because they were so large and they had all the content deals and relationships that Netflix didn't quite have at that time. But what held them back was, unfortunately, what's happening to Netflix now, which was Carl Icahn got involved with Blockbuster and kind of gutted its online efforts. So, you know, they knew because store traffic was declining in 2004, 2005. 2005 was a terrible year for them, that they were going to have to put everything that they had into their online business. But they had some board members who just did not believe that that was the way that they should go. And so they weren't able to really do what they needed to do to kill Netflix.
Howard Anderson, senior lecturer at MIT's Sloan School of Management, let me bring you in here. What is the lesson? What's the takeaway of Netflix killing Blockbuster? I mean, is this just a one-off situation, or is this something we should learn from?
It happens all the time. The issue is that well-run financial companies will make the wrong decision. They will look at, my God, we have all these stores, we have all these leases. So they go through anger. Why would our customers leave? Denial. It's not going to be important to us. Grudging acceptance. But we'll have our own thing, but really come back to the stores anyway. And then acceptance, game over. By the time the rules have changed and you realize it, it's too late.
And it's interesting, Gina Keating, you say that Amazon actually had a chance really early on. Reed Hastings and his partner, Mark Randolph, basically walk in to see Jeff Bezos in 1998 and say, like, do you want Netflix? And what happened, Gina Keating?
He made a very lowball offer for it. And, you know, the idea was that Netflix would be sort of a purveyor of basically what they're doing right now with Amazon Prime. They were going to provide, you know, they had all the the inventory, the DVDs by mail, which is what they were doing then. They weren't doing streaming. And they were going to, you know, just be sort of the people who provided that service for Amazon customers. And he just wouldn't give them enough money, and then they just said, forget it. And that actually happened several times over the, you know, ensuing years. They went back and forth with Amazon trying to figure out some kind of deal that they could do together to capture all of those customers that were coming through Amazon's doors, but Amazon just wouldn't make it economically interesting for them.
And then you say in 2000, they tried to sell Netflix, or Blockbuster was interested in Netflix, and basically, you know, the offer was $50 billion from Blockbuster. From Netflix said, we want $50 billion, right? And Blockbuster was like, we're never going to pay $50 million.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, at the time, you know, remember, it was right after the right around the time of the dot-com boom. And John Antiocco, the CEO of Blockbuster, just thought that some of those internet companies had ridiculous valuations. And $50 million for Netflix at that time, when it had, I think, less than 500,000 customers, was kind of overvalued. And they just literally laughed them out of the office.
And Howard Anderson from MIT, you know, you've looked also at a real downfall of Netflix, which was this 2011 moment where they said, look, we're going to separate the business that sends people DVDs in the mail and streaming. And what ended up happening? I mean, we see a stock price now that's under $100 a share. They topped out almost $300 a share. What happened to Netflix?
Every company will struggle once in a while. But what we're really talking about is that electrons and electronic delivery will trump atoms and physical delivery sooner or later. Everybody knew the day was coming when Blockbuster would end. It's very much like Kodak knew that digital cameras would come, and they delayed it as long as possible. They had their own digital cameras, but digital cameras would not throw off that kind of profit that silver halide film did, and they knew it was everyone in the industry knew it was coming. It just takes another 7 or 8 years for it to happen. The fact that they screwed up their customer base for a while, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there.
And Gina Keating, look ahead for us. We obviously have this company, Netflix, which is huge, has something like 30 million subscribers. Where are they going? They've obviously Reed Hastings has been, the CEO, has been embattled over the last year or so. Is this company going to survive? Is it going to thrive? What do you see ahead?
You know, the introduction of Carl Icahn on this in this situation is a little troubling. You know, he came into Blockbuster and didn't really help the situation very much. And he has been pushing for Netflix to sell itself. It's exactly the same thing that happened with Blockbuster. And that to me is more troubling than any of the competitive issues that Netflix faces right now. I mean, it's true that they have a lot of competition for content deals. But, you know, if they can survive, I don't see how the studios are going to really be able to resist centralizing their content somewhere, just because I think customers really want that. And they're going to have to figure out some sort of deal to let you have content maybe in different windows, sort of like they used to do it with cable companies and so forth. So that part of it doesn't bother me that much. I really think that they're nimble enough, and they have so much data on how consumers use their service. I mean, 15 years worth, it's more than anybody else about consumer behavior. But the whole corporate governance issue around Carl Icahn is very troubling to me. So I just can't answer that.
So you don't worry that much that it's going to be movie studios or TV studios who are going to, just as Netflix killed Blockbuster, they're going to try to kill Netflix. You're not worried about that, it sounds like.
You know, the studios, you know, I watched them really struggle with how to distribute content digitally, and they're just not good at it. They just really have not figured it out. They have a mentality of being afraid of piracy, and that holds them back a lot in terms of being creative and really trying to figure out how consumers are going to use that content and how they want to use it. So, you know, they just haven't been able to figure it out. Netflix is very accepting and fluid and understanding of customers is because it watches their subscribers so carefully. They seem to have no ego about how to use it, but of course it's not their content, so they don't really care. You know, they just want consumers to use the content the way they feel most comfortable, and that is why they've been so successful. So I'm not worried about the studios somehow coming up with some killer app. I just don't think that's going to happen. You know, they really struggled with it. They had a lot of money. They had a lot of expertise, and they just weren't able to do it. So I'm not worried about Netflix in that way. I think they're going to be fine. But like I said, you know, there are just a lot of other things happening right now with them that that could really mess them up. I mean, they don't have a ton of cash on hand. So, you know, if they get into a situation where they're distracted or whatever, I mean, I think that they could make some bad decisions.
Hmm. We'll be watching. Gina Keating, author of Netflix, The Epic Battle for America's Eyeballs. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And let me turn to Bailing Yin, professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. And I want to ask you, why was it DVD rentals that was one of the first things that really broke through, where the internet had this major advantage over Blockbuster or Hollywood Video, all these places we used to go to and rent a movie on Friday night?
Well, I think the simple idea is that the DVD was actually very thin, very light, very small, and so it was cheap to send in the mail. And I think this is a general principle for how we think about the transition from bricks and mortar to potentially their being taken over by these online businesses, is that the more and more an online business can replicate the cost of getting this item to your door cheaply, the better off they are in terms of taking over from a bricks and mortar store. So before you had DVDs, you had these video cassettes that would have been a little more costly, a little more bulky, and just that small margin of difference can make or break whether an online business would work.
And it's interesting because Gina Keating writes in Netflix about how basically the rise of the DVD happened at the same time as Netflix. And in fact, Reed Hastings, when he first saw a DVD, he had actually had trouble getting samples of them to send to himself to see if it could work in the mail. So he was hoping, right, this new technology caught on.
That's right. I think there's with all these new technologies, there's always a lot of uncertainty. So, you know, that's another reason why, despite the fact that people can see it, that this will happen at some point, this technology will take over, there is a huge lag between when people see that happening and when it actually happens.
Howard Anderson, what else besides DVD rentals was at the vanguard of getting us to switch from brick-and-mortar stores to online retailers?
Let's start with a basic premise. And remember, before I sound too intelligent here, my venture firm put $9 million into Pets.com.
Yikes.
It was world's most expensive hand puppet, right? Shopping is not pleasant. It's painful. What's your time worth? Is it worth $10, $20, $50 an hour to go to any physical store to pick up something and take it back takes an hour? So whether I am buying food or whether I am buying Apple computers or whether I'm buying music, that pain, especially at this time of the year, becomes onerous. When shopping is painful and there are better alternatives, and there is what the economists call perfect market knowledge. I am now in the market for luggage. Do I go to two or three luggage stores? Well, I might. Do I know what I want? If I know what I want, I can search the internet. I can pick out the luggage I want. I can have it shipped for free. If I'm unhappy with it, I'll send it back from free. And also remember, people like Netflix and Zappos have a great brand. Do you buy from Zappos?
I have before, yeah.
And what's the best thing about Zappos?
I think most people would say free shipping.
And you can return those shoes, unworn, I hope, for 364 days after you buy them. What is not to like about a solution like this, especially if you know what you want and there is a safety net which electronic buying, electronic delivery gives you.
You know, Bailing, Ian, it's really interesting when you think about a company like Zappos because, you know, if you're looking at Netflix, they're sending you a certain kind of content and it's all standardized. If we all want the same movie, we all can get the same movie. But you think about shoes, well, that's hard. I think somebody would have said to you 10, 15 years ago, I can't get shoes without trying them on. Some are uncomfortable. Sometimes my size ends up being a little too big and sometimes it's a little too small and I have to go up or go down or whatever. How did Zappos overcome that?
Well, I think Howard's exactly right. By creating the safety net, they make it very easy and convenient for the shopper simply to buy the shoes, maybe buy multiple pairs of them, try the one that fits, pick that one, and then send the rest back. But I think another thing that Zappos tapped into is the ability of the internet to be a two-way communication device. So if you go on their website for all these shoes, there are often many reviews from customers saying that the shoes runs a size bigger than normal, a size smaller than normal. They also are taking advantage of the fact that now you can actually push even more rich content over the internet. So they have videos where people demonstrate and show you all the angles of the shoe and actually put it on for you to see it on a person. So they've not only figured out how to make this a low-risk situation, but also amped up the amount of information they can provide to you as a business, but also employing their customers to help inform other customers.
I'm Kara Miller. We're talking about how technology is changing the way that we shop and the way that businesses sell and market their goods. And the conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. If you're just tuning in, we are talking about how the things that we buy are changing in the 21st century, from mom and pop shops to big box stores to now buying almost everything one needs online. And I'm joined by Howard Anderson, senior lecturer at MIT's Sloan School of Management, and Bailing Yin, a professor also at the Sloan School of Management. And Howard Anderson, I want to ask you about what will happen to brick and mortar stores. And let's listen to a little clip from Michael Lisicki, who's a department store historian. He was talking to CBS Sunday Morning recently, looking at where he sees the department store going.
A department store was an emporium, a place that basically carried everything for everybody. It really was the social center of a city. I'm sorry to say, I think the era of the department store has passed, and I really miss it.
Howard Anderson, is the era of the department store past?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think we're coming to a position where every day will be Cyber Monday. Some things we will always go to a store. I need a mattress. I don't care what you say. Mattresses are big and bulky. I am going to go to a store and lay on that mattress. I can't do that in a cyber world. But whole other categories will migrate. Remember, there's an implicit contract between a retailer and a customer, which is to give you value for your money. And that value is essentially able to be measured. And consumers may go look at silverware, pick up four or five pieces, figure out the style that they like, the weight, it feels right, and then go find the best deal.
So does that mean that people working and owning malls all around America should be really worried?
It doesn't happen right away. I remember years ago I was doing some work for the Envelope Manufacturers Association. They make envelopes. What's going to happen to our business? Here comes this electronic mail thing when the amount of first-class postage was 100 billion pieces of first-class mail. And our research said, for a couple years, you're going to be fine. Then you're going to see the beginnings, the growth stops. And at a certain point, it goes critical mass, and you will not get anywhere near the amount of first-class mail that you used to get. And often, when you think of it, the mail you get was generated from a computer. You've taken it in, put it into your computer, sent a check out, and that's over. That's obsolete. There will always be some kinds of stores, but there will not necessarily be anywhere near the retail strength that there was in the last 50 years.
Biling Yin, I'm going to play you a little clip of Ron Johnson, who came from Apple Computer. Now he's the CEO of JCPenney, really trying to revitalize this store that was founded more than 100 years ago. And here he is taking CBS on a tour of a prototype store in Texas and describing a kind of new innovative approach that JCPenney has adopted.
We're here today in the future JCP. You know, we're going to transition JCPenney from a promotional department store we call a specialty department store, which is an entirely new way to shop. We don't call it an aisle. We actually call it a street.
A street.
It's a place to be, and it becomes the new navigation path for shopping. Because in the age of the internet, you've got to do more than be a place to buy. You've got to be a place people love to be. And so the street allows you to kind of do things that you couldn't do elsewhere.
Biling Yin, is there hope for JCPenney, for innovation there, or do you think the writing's pretty much on the wall here?
Well, I think they're taking absolutely the right approach in terms of figuring out how can we distinguish ourselves from the online experience. And what JCPenney could do with their current stores is, as he's saying, create some sort of experience that people enjoy having. So it's not just that they're providing a product at a cheap price, but they're providing a service in terms of entertainment, it seems, in this case.
Now, I have to say, both their stock price and their earnings have been terrible over the last year. So, I mean, again, this question, is it enough to make these changes, or are we just, you know, it's 5 minutes to midnight and it just doesn't matter?
Yeah, I think that, you know, part of JC's strategy is going to have to also be thinking about what is the product mix that they're going to offer along with this entertainment. So you could imagine that absolutely standardized products for which I know exactly what I want, I can easily go online and get the best price. What two things that JCPenney can offer is, one, if they have this entertainment area where they also are very good at figuring out how to help you select among a ton of different products that may exist online and say, these are the five products that really would suit you. That is one way in which they can offer a service that makes them more value added. And just the second thing is that they need to think about those products which are more specialty products, which are more unique, which they can solely offer so that maybe the customer isn't tempted to go online and simply find the price, or they can't find it anywhere else online.
Howard Anderson, is there a formula for having a brick-and-mortar store that works? And I'll throw in here that Nordstrom, which is a department store that started also at the beginning of the 1900s, just like JCPenney did, is doing actually pretty well. Now, it has a very different target audience, very upscale target audience. Is there a winning formula for a brick-and-mortar store or no?
There's a couple kinds that will work. Nordstrom's, yes, high touch, high feel. Costco, low touch, no feel. Costco comes out fourth in customer service and any kind of rating, and they don't even have customer service. Ron Johnson has got a dead horse at his feet.
Hmm.
I think it was Warren Buffett that once said, when a manager with an impeccable reputation meets an institution that is truly dysfunctional, it is the institution that will keep its reputation.
Hmm. Okay, so, but let's go back to Nordstrom then for a minute. So if JCPenney, in your view, is sort of on the gurney here, is there that possibility for high-end stores to maintain? Nordstrom famously has piano players in their lobbies and stuff. Is there the potential for the places that charge a premium to stay in business, or the high-end customers migrating online too?
If I have a salesperson at JCPenney who is making more than $12 or $13 an hour, I've got a problem. I do not have an expert there. I go into the Apple store for the Genius Bar. I need someone to be a guide in an unsafe environment. JCPenney is not going to be that guide. Nordstrom's a different kind of feel. And remember, in some cases, I'm going to go to Nordstrom, see what I want, and then check, is it available elsewhere and whatever. Now, what some of the stores are starting to do is play with same-day delivery. You know, can I buy something electronically? So we're saying is, can a JCPenney.com, for example, offer me the both of the best of both worlds? Maybe or maybe not. Maybe they tell me that people who bought that brand of towel also bought this brand of soap and whatever. But it is 40 miles of hard, dusty road for Ron Johnson.
Piling in, you know, Howard Anderson mentions this idea of same-day delivery. Amazon's already got that in 10 test markets. We don't think of certain kinds of things, food, diapers, cleaning products, as the kind of thing that people get online. But is that going to change?
I think those are exactly the things that people would much rather have delivered to their home than have to haul them out of their in and out of their trunk and go to the grocery store to get those things. So yes, if Amazon can provide those same day service and at your doorstep, especially for those heavy bulk items that again are standardized and people sort of know what they're getting, I think those are products that will be more common online.
So this isn't just Macy's should be worried, but maybe supermarkets or Walmart or Target should be worried too.
Absolutely. I think what they need to worry about, though, is the current business model for these large common goods retailers is that they have large scale to hold all these large items that everyone needs on a daily basis. And now what they have to think about is that the only people who are going to go to their store are people who need it rather than same day, that hour. So there'll be a immediate shopping for those people, but that means they would have to carry much less inventory and they have to think about how they shrink their current real estate.
So then, Howard Anderson, look ahead for us. If it's not just the department stores, it's not just the malls, it's also the grocery stores, the big box stores that may be losing some of their customers, what does the paint the picture of what the future looks like a little bit in retail?
What a retailer measures gross profit per cubic inch per hour. Think about that metric, gross profit per cubic inch per hour. So orange juice, I give it more space. Bulky towels, I give less space. But look at Amazon for a moment and Kindle. I can do impulse purchasing of a book. I don't have to wait the next day for Amazon or Federal Express to deliver it. I read a review in the New York Times. 3 minutes later, that book is there. That is something that no retailer is going to be able to do unless they are a Netflix or an Amazon or whatever. So when I look at, you know, this instant gratification, I say that's pretty powerful. I don't have to necessarily do any more than look at a review, buy it, it's there. Music is the same way. Look at Best Buy. You would have thought when Circuit City went out of business, Best Buy would do great. But Best Buy has not done great. And they are in the same relative position as Blockbuster was.
And Pineling, people are using Best Buy, interestingly, for something that I think really probably concerns Best Buy, which is this thing called showrooming. Well, they'll go in, check it out, they go home and order it on Amazon and be like, yeah, now I've looked at it, and yep, that is what I'd like. But they don't get it from Best Buy. What do you do about that if you're Best Buy?
Yeah, I think that's something that Best Buy really has to worry about. They're basically incurring all the costs for some low-end retailer to sell the same product. There aren't too many things that Best Buy can do, but I do think one of the things that they can do is try to figure out how might I be able to get this person to buy it here. Can they target discounts so that if the person is in the store, they could do some sort of price matching? Another thing is this may be a little harder for something that's a big ticket item, such as the kinds of electronics that Best Buy sells, but figure out how they can cross sell to the customer. So one thing that Best Buy does have is not only the content, the electronic goods, but the content that goes on the electronic goods. So can they perhaps bundle purchases and be able to offer the customer a discount for buying more products that the customer would not be able to replicate by buying each product separately at a cheaper price online. So make it just, again, very easy for the customer to buy the whole package And make the customer think, wow, it would be more complex to buy each of those individual items and go search for it online and put it all together and have it arrive in many different packages.
In a different way, Barnes & Noble has almost done that with the Nook. I mean, I wonder if part of the reason they're alive and Borders is no more is because they jumped on the bandwagon and realized that it's not just a question of selling the physical thing. It's also, it's also capitalizing on, like Howard said, on the impulse purchase. When somebody's sitting at home and thinking, I want that book, you need to be a part of that equation.
I think that's absolutely right. For a long time, retailers have understood that the first priority is get that customer in the door. If they can get the customer in the door, they can make the sale. And it's very unlikely that the customer will, although people care about price because of the cost of transportation, it's very unlikely that the customer will go out and buy something else online. It's become much easier to do that because now you have mobile devices that accompany the customer into the store. So they might actually be right in your store and buy it online. But that's where you have to think very creatively about how else might you make this experience much easier for the customer such that they buy from you rather than take that extra moment to go elsewhere online.
Let me ask both of you a question that might be a little tough, but is there an area of retail, some sector, some subset of something that you think, boy, I still can't think how online can disrupt this area, at least not yet? Howard Anderson, is there an area that's safe?
There's no area that's safe. There are areas that will be somewhat protected for a while. For example, if you are buying a scarf at Hermes or Hermes, some people call it. you would like to see it. You like to feel it. Is it cashmere? We're not going to solve that problem yet. But aside from that, you start to look at how the world begins. We used to go to banks to deposit every check and get cash. Do we do that anymore? No. I mean, theoretically, we have disaggregated this. What we're really talking about is distributors. I mean, Best Buy and all these guys are distributors. You have the manufacturer, the distributor, and the consumer. If you look, for example, at the Nike store on Newbury Street, one of the world's most expensive per square foot. Is Nike trying to make that store profitable? Actually, it's one giant billboard. And what they're saying is buy Nike wherever you go, come in and see it. We don't have a big problem if you go down to City Sports and buy that same Nike shoes. What a retailer will do, like Best Buy, is they will arm twist their manufacturers, give us our own special SKUs, products that only we sell, so that it's not really possible to measure us versus someone else. And they'll get away with that for a while.
So it's really, what you're saying about the Nike store is it's really showrooming. I mean, it's just Nike showrooming for Nike.
Exactly.
Okay. And it's interesting, Piling, let me ask you the same question. Is there anything that you think is safe in retail?
So if one considers services as part of retail, I think those are the areas that are safe. Anything where you actually are depending on the contact of another human being or the advice of another human being. So, for instance, I happen to be a co-owner of a Pilates studio, and we're doing quite well and really don't see too much threat from an online substitute because people really care about the connection with their instructor. You could think about haircut services, spa services. These are things that you actually need to interact with another person, and it seems that that would be hard to replicate online.
And finally, are there technologies that you think are moving us towards even getting a better experience of a product online? I mean, you talked a little bit about Zappos and now how you can watch people walk around in different shoes. Are there other technologies that people are working on so we even get a better sense of our products without going anywhere?
Yeah, I think there are these almost sci-fi kind of attempts, but they're happening to try to replicate the smells that might come out of your computer screen, or to take a photo of yourself and be able to put it online and put clothing on that photo and actually see how it would exactly look on you. But those are pretty far down the line. Definitely people are trying to hit that holy grail, because that would change a lot of competition for a lot more products.
Yeah, that'd be a whole new world. We're talking about how the way things we buy have changed in the digital age. And I've been speaking with Howard Anderson, a senior lecturer at MIT's Sloan School of Management, and Bai-Ling Yin, a professor also at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This world is big and wild and half insane.
And Emily Rooney is with me now in the studio. Hey, Emily. Hey,
it's a little switching topic here, Kara.
Yeah.
Have you ever hit a deer with your car?
I haven't, fortunately.
I have, and apparently 4,000 people a day do it.
Hmm.
That's just one of the things that Jim Sturba calls part of our nature wars. You know, too many geese, bear, coyotes everywhere, but he's got a theory on why this is happening, and guess who's to blame?
Yeah, I'm sure as we build more houses and drive deers out of their habitat, that's what you get. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Emily Rooney, and this is Boston Public Radio.
My head upon my pillow. Little girl come play beneath my window. Though she's far from home.